This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
We're going to get started, folks. So, normally I would start by saying hello, but since it's Tisha B'Av, I won't do that. One of the questions I've been getting a lot, actually, in the last 24 hours is, wait a second, I thought you're not allowed to learn Torah on Tisha B'Av, which is true. So the answer to that is that you're allowed to learn the parts of Torah, Tanakh, Gemara, Kinot, that are sad and make you sad. So my goal for the next hour and 15 minutes is to make you sad, okay? You're going to have the tendency, you're going to want to laugh, but fight that. Really, we're going to try and be somber and think about what this day is really about. It's a big question what this day is really about. And one of the things I think is so amazing about Tisha B'Av is that there are just all of these reasons given again and again and again throughout Jewish history and Jewish texts. And every year someone says, this is the message of Tisha B'Av. And it's all right, because that's where we're at Pardes, and everything is all right. That's all correct, right? All of those reasons are true, and throughout Jewish history, we've chosen this day as a day to sort of, as sort of a catch-all for all of the horrors and tragedies and travesties that have happened to the Jewish people. So what that also means is that not only is it a day of memory and of remembering the tragedies that happened to the Jewish people, but it's also a day that is open to us to think about what is going on in our time. The fact that Chazal, the fact that the rabbis chose to list a series of tragedies on one day means that this is the day that invites us to think about our own times, our own experiences, what's happening. And I want to tell you that the title of this session is called Does Tolerance Lead to Indifference? And I want to just posit right at the beginning that I think what this Tisha B'Av is about, this year in 2016, 5776, is the problem of indifference. And maybe even more, the problem of feeling like there is nothing I can do. We are living in a time, I don't usually say this, I don't usually talk this way, but we are living in a time where there is, everywhere you look, there is tragedy and fear and a general feeling of, well, what can I do? What can I, little tiny me, what can I really do to change the world? What can I really do to make a difference in all of this terror and tragedy and fear and audacity that is happening? And that's what I think Tisha B'Av is about this year. And what's interesting is this issue of indifference is one that goes back quite far in Jewish history. And we're going to be taking a look at two particular moments in Jewish history where there was a reaction, but perhaps it was not the right reaction. Or there was a reaction, but it was misunderstood, misplaced. And the question, I think, is it just about reaction or is it about action? That's sort of our question as we look at these sources going forward. One of the things that people say about the concept of tolerance, today's topic of the day is tolerance, is that perhaps tolerance just means I don't care very much, right? If I, the concept of live and let live, right? I'll do what I do what you do, we all just sort of get along and exist next to each other. Maybe that just means I don't really care what you're doing. I don't really care who you are because I just live next to you, but what you do in your own home is your business. It doesn't really affect me. And I wonder if the concept of live and let live is actually a Jewish concept. I'm not sure. I'm not sure live and let live is actually something that we believe in Judaism. Actually, we believe in Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh LaZeh. We actually believe that we are responsible one for another. And so the question is, as we look at these sources and go forward, the question is, where is there a reaction And where is there an action? And what does Tisha B'Av ask us to feel, ask us to experience, and ask us to do? That's really the question. What does Tisha B'Av ask us to do? Not just to feel. Feeling is good. But what are you going to do about that feeling, I think is really a major and important question. Okay? Everyone with me? Everyone okay so far? Questions, comments, critiques? Everyone's okay. Okay. Good. Yes. I'm just going to hand you this. We do. It's true. Good. Excellent. Excellent. Right. So it's a very important point, right? The question of the doomsday, right? The question of, are we really living in such bad times? Are these really tragic times? And it's interesting you're saying in terms of the Jewish people, right? Perhaps the Jewish people are in a good situation. I was referring more to, I think, the world right now. More the world, the whole world. And that, I think, is a really interesting question, you know. So that is, in general, an interesting question about particularism. Is Tisha B'Av just about a day of mourning for what's happening for the Jewish people, or can we expand it to think about what's happening for the whole world? I think it's an interesting and important question, and one maybe that we'll see as we go. There's a bunch of different quotes at the beginning of your page. The one that I really want to focus on is by Elie Wiesel, Zichron Alivracha, and he recently passed away. And one of the things, when I told my colleagues I was going to be talking about indifference on Tisha B'Av, yeah, don't look. Look at me. Look up here. Yeah, right. Just for 1 second. Otherwise, you'll be bored in a minute. The first thing everyone said was, oh, you're talking about Elie Wiesel, right? Because Elie Wiesel's major position was that indifference is the thing we must be fighting constantly, right? So if you take a look at the second quote on your pages, he says here, the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it's indifference. And the opposite of life is not death, it's indifference. Because of indifference, one dies before one actually dies. Right? That actually the greatest problem that exists on earth is the problem of indifference. I want to know, what do people think about this? What are your responses to this? People agree? Yes. Just tell me your name. I'm sorry.
My name's
Mira.
And, you know, it comes back from my cultural background. I'm Australian. You know, people are very indifferent. You tell someone you're Jewish, okay, you know, they don't feel fabulous. They don't have any positive feelings. They don't have any negative feelings. You know, you live and let live.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very Australian attitude. That is indifference.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Good. Okay. So it exists. And you think that that's a positive thing, Mira, because
it's definitely being a very positive thing. You know, you go to other places in the world. You go to Europe and you see people feeling very strong about a lot of issues. And that causes animosity.
Right. Good. 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 Right? So what I hear, Mira, what I hear you saying is, yeah, you know what? Actually, sometimes indifference is great because at least we're not killing each other. Right? It's actually fantastic. I don't really care what you're doing, and I don't really care what you're doing, and you don't really care what I'm doing, so fine. Let's just all move on in the world, and everything's okay, right? At least it doesn't lead to animosity or, right, God forbid, even, right, death or tragedy, right? So what's so wrong with indifference, Mira says to us? That's a great question. Yeah, yes. Right. Yeah. Right. right? So actually, I don't want there to be indifference, is what I hear you saying, right? I don't want there to be indifference, because actually what that means is I can look evil in the eye and do nothing. It's true, live and let live, but actually live and let live means live, and if you're not living, I won't do anything to get involved. I won't even get involved there, right? Not my problem, not my issue. And you can be a good person, right? Theoretically, a good person who's just sitting next to something terrible that is happening, and you have an obligation there to get involved, actually. And doing nothing is actually an action. What I think is interesting is, I think sometimes that inaction is inaction. I'm doing nothing, I'm not doing anything, I'm just sitting next to you. But actually, inaction is an action. And that, I think, is gonna be interesting for us as we look at the pieces from our texts about this question, right? Inaction as action. You actually can't sit still. If you're sitting next to something that is terrible and tragic, standing still or sitting still is a choice, in as much as, right, getting involved is a choice. They're both choices and they're both actions, okay? So that's something I think that we need to think about as we go on. Yes, just tell me your name.
Lisa.
Lisa.
If I tell somebody I'm Jewish, I don't want you to help me.
Right. Yeah, good. Okay, that's a really important point, right? What if the person next to me is like, No, I want you to leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I didn't ask for help. I don't need your help. And it's a very interesting question, because there, no, I don't want to be indifferent. I'm getting involved can sometimes be incredibly paternalistic, right? Condescending, judgmental. So there are dangers also to action, right? Which is true. So of course, at the end of the day, it's all going to be about balance, right? And how we, but the question I think that's going to be interesting is, what is the obligation on the seer? Right, maybe it's their obligation to ask, do you need help here? And if the person says no, then, but are they then exempted from, right, are they exempt from asking the question? That I think is an important question. So as we watch sort of tragedies and travesties occur, watching the Jewish people's reaction and their choice to or not to take responsibility, I think is going to be really interesting. Okay, my friends? So what we're going to do, I'm sorry, I'm going to put us into Chavruta now, okay? What we're going to do is we're going to do a little bit of Chavruta, as we do here at Pardes, right? Everything we do has Chavruta. And why do we do, for those people who are maybe new to Pardes? I don't know if people have know Chavruta or have experienced it before, but what is Chavruta? Studying with a partner, right? Studying in pairs. You turn to the person next to you. You read the text out loud, and there are questions at the bottom. But why do we do Chavruta? Why? Yes. Oh, beautiful. To see the divine in the other person. Wow, thank you. We could be done now. I think we're good, right, for the day. Beautiful. Tell me your name. Sorry. Aviva. Beautiful. Okay, good. And what else? What else? To get feedback. It makes things what? Makes things what? Go quicker, right? Sometimes. Sometimes it goes a lot slower, actually, right? We're being honest. Yeah, okay, good. What else? What else? Excellent, right? You need someone else to sharpen them up. You need someone to push you a little bit, right? The point of Chavruta is to push us somewhere we couldn't get to on our own, okay? So you're going to turn to the person next to you, and you're going to, one person's going to read the text out loud. Wait, don't go yet. Hold on, stay with me, because you don't know what I'm going to tell you to do. Hold on. Because there's a lot of text on these pages, and we're not going to get them all in the next 17 minutes together in Chavruta, unfortunately. So what I'm going to ask you to do, guys, this is very important. One, sources, 1, 2, 3, and 5. 1, 2, 3, and 5. And then I'm going to do something even more crazy to make sure you're really listening to me, which is I don't want you to read them in that order. I want you to read them like this. 1, 3, 2, and 5. That's how you're reading, in that order. 1, 3, 2, and 5, okay? 1, 3, 2, and 5. Turn to the person next to you. We're going to do Chavruta for 17 and a half minutes. Okay? Go for it. Go for it. It's always hard to end chavruta. It's always a hard thing. So don't think of this as the end of your chavruta, but rather a continuation with many chavruta partners, which I like to call an infatuta. We're just going to have one giant chavruta now, okay? Don't worry. An infinite number of chavruta partners, okay? Thank God. There's always a chavruta partner. You just don't realize it. Text and another person, and you're good to go. Okay, so the first source that you looked at together in chavruta is from Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Tanit 30b. And Tractate Tanit, the end, towards the end of the tractate, is when we start to hear about the laws of the various fast days and exactly what the holiday of Tisha B'Av is all about, right? The word Tanit means fast, and in fact, we're talking here about a prescribed fast day, as opposed to the rest of the tractate, which really is dealing with not prescribed fast days, but fast days in reaction, speaking of reactions, in reaction to a travesty or calamity that has occurred to the Jewish community. So here we are in Tractate Tanit 30b, and we're told the following. Rashbag Omer, Kol ha'ochel v'shoteh b'tisha b'av, ki'ilu ochel v'shoteh b'yom ha'kippurim. Right? Anyone who eats or drinks on the ninth of Av, it is as if he has eaten and drinking on the... And drinking? That's not a word. That's not a word. Sorry about that. Drank. Thank you. That's incorrect. On the Day of Atonement. Okay? So let's just start right there, my friends. Let's just start with that statement. Can you tell me, what does that mean? Anybody who eats and drinks on Tisha B'Av, it's like he ate and drank on Yom HaKippurim. Yes, Rachel. Good. Excellent. Excellent, right? Very, very important point, right? We are instantaneously trying to... Careful, you okay? Okay. You're instantaneously... You good? Okay. You're instantaneously trying to connect Tisha B'Av to Yom Kippur. And in fact, I'm just going to tell you a little fun aside. The first shiur I ever gave publicly for Pardes, you were there, was with my mom, was about the comparison between Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av. And in fact, many, many of our customs and our practices on Tisha B'Av, we take directly from Yom Kippur. So what's interesting here is we're watching Chazal, we're watching the rabbis connect these two holidays, right? And which means, my friends, what does that mean? Is that the natural thing that the community would have felt? No, right? The fact that I have to say to you, oh, FYI, eating and drinking on Yom Kippur, on Tisha B'Av, is like you ate and drink on Yom Kippur, means that it's not actually my natural instinct. From my natural instinct, I wouldn't need to make a law, right? So it's not actually my natural reaction to Tisha B'Av, which is interesting to think about, that my natural reaction to Tisha B'Av would not be fasting. I have to tell you, take this thing seriously. Take this thing seriously, right, Rashbag says to us, which I think is really interesting and important to think about. Okay, that's the first thing we're told. Then we're told, just give me one second, sorry. Then we're told, right, Rabbi Akiva says, not just can you not eat and drink, but in fact, kol ha'osem melacha b'tisha b'av, just doing your regular work on Tisha B'Av, a person like that will not see, eino ro'es siman bracha le'olam, will not see any blessing forever. Okay, what does that mean? What is Rabbi Akiva saying to us? Don't be scared.
It's more important than Yom
Kippur. Why?
Because you won't get any blessing. When Yom Kippur comes, you don't talk about blessing and talk about the connection.
Mm. Okay, interesting, right? That's interesting. We don't necessarily tie siman bracha to Yom Kippur. Perhaps we're trying to say it's even more important. Although the truth is, if you would do melacha, and the Torah is very clear about what melacha means, right? Creative activity, the way that we talk about not performing any of the 39 categories of melacha, of work on Shabbat, the same is true for Yom Kippur. And in fact, the punishment is death, right? So maybe that's a bit more severe than siman bracha, but it's an interesting question about, right, is he talking about melacha proper here, right, real one of the 39 categories, or is he talking simply about work, writing emails all day, right? Is that what he's imagining? It's an interesting question, but the idea here is you will not come to see any blessing. You think you're getting ahead by clearing out that inbox. Actually, right, there, no good will come from this work, right? You will not see a siman bracha, a sign of blessing from your work. There's another hand? Yes. Just tell me your name, I'm sorry.
Sherry.
Sherry.
Maybe it's like this. If you work, then you
Yafeh.
In other words, because you're not appreciating the picture. So like if you're working, you know, you're looking at maybe the wrong things that I don't know. If you know what I'm saying, only through the mourning do you really appreciate what you're blessed.
Yeah, fair. Beautiful, right? Sherry's saying to us, I think, right, that what Rabbi Akiva is asking for is a presence of mind, right? Distracting yourself with your inbox. Sorry, I keep going back to that. It's my own burden I'm carrying, right? But distracting yourself with your emails, your inbox, your meetings, all those things, right, is a way to actually not be present in the morning, right? And that, if we do that, if we don't allow ourselves to be present in the morning, even when good things happen, this is what I hear you saying, even when wonderful things happen, I'm also going to have my head stuck in an inbox, right? I'm not, if I can't be present for the negative, I also won't be present for the good stuff. And when the good stuff happens, I won't even feel it. Right? Excellent. Very, very nice. And then the sages come along, interestingly, and they say, I wonder if they're saying what you think they're saying, Sheriff. If you think this is an addition to Rabbi Akiva or it's something else. But the sages come along and they say, not just what Rabbi Akiva said, and not just what Rashbag said, but they actually say, right, anyone who does melacha, this work, on Tisha B'Av, right, ve'eino mitabel al Yerushalayim, and doesn't mourn for Jerusalem, which is interesting, guys, because there's a connection there, right? Yafeh, good, right. There are two things happening here. You're doing your work and you're not mourning. And this maybe goes back to what Sherry was saying about, because your work allows you to not feel the pain of the day, right? If you do that, you're also not going to see besimchata, right? You're not going to be there for the joy, okay? I want to ask you guys, do you think that Rabbi Akiva and Chachamim, right, and the sages here are saying the same thing? Or different things? And if you think different things, then what do you think the difference is? Yes, sir.
Well, it's not the meaning. It's a difference. Yes.
Good. Okay, good. And therefore? Right. It's only the rejection of the mourning. That's what you're saying, right? The difference between Chachamim, right, the sages, and Rabbi Akiva here is that perhaps the sages say, I need an additional piece, which is rejecting the mourning itself, then I won't get to see her glory. Yes? Yes? Okay, good. Yafeh. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, I want to ask, why is it? Why is this true? Is it true that if I didn't mourn for Jerusalem, I won't be able to celebrate her? Really? Why? I didn't know Jerusalem existed for 20 years. And then I show up in Jerusalem, and it happens to be, I don't want to choose it, happens to be Yom Ha'atzmaut, okay? And the whole city is excited and partying, and right? I can't feel that. I don't experience that. It's not a real phenomenon. Yeah, Ben.
And that's essentially kind of what's going on, where it's very, very unpleasant to deal with destruction and even a quarter of the things that are mentioned in Ava. And it causes a lot of people to just kind of shy away from
distract themselves. Good.
And but a fundamental part of a relationship is first and foremost being there for the person when they're down. Jerusalem isn't just a place that when you're happy and everything, but I think you need to be able to feel its pain as well, however difficult.
Beautiful, right? Such an important word that Ben just added to the conversation, which I think is really, really critically important, which is relationship, right? That there's a moment here where we're saying, listen, this is not a place. This is not just a place that you visit. This is a place that you have a relationship with. So if you can't be there in the bad times, you're also not going to be there in the good times, right? Which is a very interesting perspective, right, on what it means to be in relationship, taking the negative with the positive, right, is a very interesting idea. And it's an immediate cry, I think, for this idea of you can't feel nothing. This is not a place where we allow you to feel nothing. You're either mourning or you're rejoicing, but there's no parv, right, relationship to the land of Israel. You just don't have a parv relationship. And if you do, right, it means you have somehow allowed yourself to be distracted from the reality that is happening around you. Right? That's what melacha has come to mean, a distraction from actually being in the reaction, being in that relationship. Okay? Yes. Just tell me your name. I'm sorry.
My name's Laura.
Laura? Yep. Beautiful, right? Good. You're positing that I don't feel joyful when my inbox gets closed down. I think there's a physiological thing happening there, but no, I'm just kidding. But but Laura's point, really, really interesting. We've talked a lot about the mind and our emotional state, but what about our physical state, right? That's also important. How do I physically distract myself or do other things that take me away? Which, by the way, is so interesting because so much of what we do on Tisha B'Av to get into a particular mindset is physical, in terms of not eating and drinking and washing. And so it's interesting to think about your read, I think is beautiful, Laura, in that you're tying us back to Reshvag, right? You gotta physically do something. And if you're physically doing work, right, is there a way in which you're distracting yourself or actually experiencing, more than just distracting yourself, right, experiencing something that's gonna take you out of that tragedy and sadness. Okay, so now we're gonna move on, my friends, to source number 3 on your pages. I know we went out of order. It's good. It just means I'm going to keep you awake. Those of us who struggle with our caffeine addiction, my job is to keep you awake. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Halacha.
Not the halachic decision.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's a big question. It's a great big question that we're not going to deal with now, okay? The halachic question of can you work on Tisha B'Av, should you work on Tisha B'Av, is a very interesting question. Luckily for us, they've been talking about it for 2,000 years. Rabbi Akiva also weighed in and had the same issue. So I'm going to leave that to ask your personal halachic authority, and we're going to go on to source number 3, if I can. Okay, so it's called passing the buck, my friends. Okay, source number 3, source number 3, okay? We're told something incredibly interesting, my friends. We have here an explanation, an interpretation of Bamidbar Numbers 14:1, which you guys saw in source number 2, describes the reaction of the people post the Meraglim as the spies come back from Israel and they report on their experiences there. The people cry and wail and moan. And what are they crying about, my friends? That we're never going to be able to make it. And why did you take me out of Egypt? Just take me back to Egypt. A very, very devastating moment in Jewish history, right? And the rabbis come along and say the following. Amar Rava, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, right? Rabba says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, right? That night, when they were weeping all night, saying, why did you take us out of Egypt? Take us back there, post the Meraglim, post the spies' report to the Jewish people. That night was Tisha B'Av. Okay, and they spent some time. The earlier lines before this were spending time when they went out in Tammuz and when they came back and how long, and they work out all the math and it's all great. Okay? But they figure out that the night of the ninth of Av was the night that the Jewish people sit down and cry to go back to Egypt. God says to them, because you wept, atem bachitem b'chiyah shel chinam. You wept a pointless, a meaningless, a weeping for no reason. V'ani koveh lachem b'chiyah l'dorot. Then I will create for you a weeping for generations. And that's what we know. So added to our travesty list of Tisha B'Av, the ninth of Av, right? Not only was Temple 1 destroyed and Temple 2 destroyed, but in fact now we're learning that back to the Bible, my friends, okay? All the way back in Jewish history, there was another travesty that befell the Jewish people, and that was that the Jewish people cried. Okay. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, Temple number 1 and 2 versus crying a little bit. I'm not really sure. And if we read the book of Bamidbar, there's a lot of crying. A lot of kvetching, right? Part of our inheritance is some kvetching. Those of us who enjoy it, it's good. It's good to know. It goes way back, right? Okay, so there's some... Okay, so they cried. All right. I need you to help me out with this, my friends. I don't really get this, right? Okay. I don't say every time the Jewish people complained and kvetched and cried to Moshe and to God that that was the ninth of Av, right? Miraculously, a lot of my ninth of Av is in the desert. And we don't say that. So what is it particularly? And you guys already read source number 2, right? A little snippet of what they seems happening. So I want to know. I want to understand, why is it that the rabbis of the Talmud are interested in tying the miraglim, the sin of the spies, to the ninth of Av? There's a lot of hands. So if you want to speak, raise your hands. Hi, don't worry. It's good. There's room for you all. Hi. Raise your hands high. I want to make sure we get you all. Okay, this is it. This is your chance, my friend. So it's now or never. Okay, good. So we're going this way, okay? Remember that you raised your hands. I'm not going to remember. Go ahead, Lynn. Okay, fantastic. Okay, so this is not saying I want food, I want meat, I want water, I want to be comfortable. That's not what it was about. It's not about my seat on the plane right now. It's that the destination is the problem, and I don't actually believe that what? The faith in what do you think they lost?
In God.
In God, okay. I don't actually believe that God is going to be with me to make sure we conquer this land. Yes? Okay, fantastic. Good, yes. Okay, fantastic. So we have an agreement that there's a lack of faith here, either in God or in the leadership to get them through this. Okay, fantastic. Yes. Beautiful. Beautiful. No, you can say it.
That by giving up their sovereignty, by not going into the land, they were later going to give up the sovereignty.
Mm. Beautiful. Right, which is so interesting, actually, Charlie, what you're saying. I think it's so interesting because it's not just about a lack of faith. It's actually perhaps there is a desire to run away from responsibility. No, take me back to Egypt where I was just a slave. I don't know. I'm not involved in politics. I'm not involved in policies. I don't know what to do. I don't know. I make my bricks. That's what I do. Don't ask me to do more. It's true. I'm in terrible pain and it's devastating, but at least it's not my responsibility, right? So that's a really interesting idea, right, about deciding or asking to be put back into a position of not taking responsibility for something. Beautiful. Yes.
So you're thinking, oh, maybe we made a major error in God's
Right. Yeah, it's so interesting. It's deep, like we're quick to find out what it, it's also my fault I set the question up like that. I didn't say, isn't this problematic? Right? But it is deeply problematic. Are you kidding me? Okay, so a generation messed up. And by the way, it's not like they didn't pay for it, right? That generation died in the desert. Wouldn't that be enough? What, now another? Okay, fine. And I'm going to make sure you cry. I mean, what? That's what we're talking, that's God? That's what we're talking about? That, although I wonder, my friends, maybe that is the God of Tisha B'Av, right? I don't know. If we read Eicha, it sounds like there is some of this theology. And part of what happened, part of why I brought you guys source number four, Aniha Gever, I'm the person who experiences this. I am literally crying and God is not listening. So trying to find, I think it's a very important point, right? But I wonder about the God of Tisha B'Av for us. Is this God who is, seems to be vengeful, seems to be heartbreaking, seems to be sort of immature. Okay, well, fine, you whine then, you're going to whine your whole lives, right? Like, no, I don't want to believe in a God like that. And yet, Aniha Gever, right, chapter 3 of Eicha, source number 4 on your pages, is exactly that. He says here, right, I call out all day, I'm crying to God, and God doesn't listen. It's even worse, actually, than Rabbi Yochanan. It's not just that I'm going to make sure you cry to me, and then I'll be there. I just need you to cry. I need this relationship, and then I'll be there. Chapter 3 of Eicha says, no, I'm still not going to be there. Not only am I going to make you cry for generations, but you're not even going to be there. I'm not even going to be there for you in that crying. So, you know, it's incredibly devastating. It's an incredibly devastating image of God. And I don't want, there's ways in which we can make it better. I just want to say, we can make it better. There's many, many sources that make God better and offer an alternative theology to this, but I wonder about how we want to do that on Tisha B'Av, and I wonder if it's not true. I wonder if Tisha B'Av is a day of making space, actually, for feeling like not only has God abandoned us, but God has been a vengeful God. And then we don't stop there, right? Okay, that's it. Okay, we can all go home, right? But then there's a question of, so what does that mean? What does it mean about faith? What does it mean about responsibility? What does it mean about how I walk in the world? If one of my understandings of how God behaves in the world is that God is a vengeful God, what does that mean about me? So Rabbi Yochanan, I think, is saying, well, let's look. Let's look back and look at the moment, look at another moment in Jewish history where we failed. And what exactly was that failing about, right? Perhaps because the experience is one of total abandonment, right? And revenge. Then I have to think, well, I could either just say, well, that's that, right? Or perhaps, right, in terms of our indifference piece, what does that mean about how I act? Ben, you want to say something? Yeah. Right.
I think it is very interesting to think about all the various events that Tisha B'Av tends to commemorate.
Right.
And if you think about what is in common with all those events besides destruction and heartbreak and tears and blood. And one of them is the subject of your sheer, essentially, indifference is that failure to act. Mm.
Beautiful. I want excellent. Very, very important point. I want to just add to it, and I want us to notice very, very carefully what happens in Numbers 14, okay? And 13, 14, okay? I want us to just notice one thing, okay? Numbers 13, 30, my friends. Then Caleb, okay? Caleb says, right? He says to the people, Source 2. Numbers 13, 30. Verse 30 there, okay? Thank you, Rachel. Right? Then Caleb silenced the people, okay? The people are grumbling and they're scared and Caleb says to the people, what does he say to their guys? What does he say to them? Ki yachol nuchala. We can do it. Okay? And what do the, and look, I want you, we changed their names right here to Anashim, right? Veha Anashim 31. But the men who had gone up with him said, Lo nuchal. La'alo tada'am. Right? We cannot do it. Let me ask you a question. It's a great debate, right? Great debaters, when they posit something, bring what? Proof. What does Kalev say? We can do it. Any proof? Any reason we can do it? No. Why can we do it? Because we can. Right. Well, it's interesting. No, I think you're right that there's a faith point here. But I think what's interesting to me is Kalev and the spies are looking at the same information. It's the same information, right? The spies also know they have God with them, right? It's the same exact information. The difference is nuchal and lo nuchal. That's the difference. We can do it, we can't do it. That's the only difference between what they're saying in terms of the facts on the ground. Can we or can't we? One says we can with the same information, and one says we can't, right? And I think I'd like to posit that perhaps the reason why Rabbi Yochanan wants to tie this event to Tisha B'Av is exactly this attitude. We can or we can't. Tisha B'Av has been a time of crying perhaps because we said or we thought or we believed, lo nuchal, we can't do it. Can't. What can I do? Ugh, it's terrible. It's a terrible time. What can I do? Can I or can't I, right? Okay, now we're going to go to source number 5, my friends, which I think is so interesting because I think it's a major challenge to what I just said. Major, which is good because we should never just take things at face value. Let's look at source number 5. Just give me 1 second, okay? Right. Right. Absolutely. Right. And it's interesting. It's a very interesting point to think about, right? I think this is probably a Tu B'Av shir. The Tu B'Av shir would be, right? So we come back next week. The Tu B'Av shir, right, would be exactly that. What are the moments in Jewish history where we said, yes, we can? Where we said, okay. The odds are against us, and we had faith. We believed, we took action. I think it's important, I don't want to lose Ben's point also, sometimes the action we take is also not right. It's not true that every time you take action or you react to indifference, it's correct. But perhaps the Meraglim are saying, yeah, but still we're going to try, right? So and it's an interesting question because I think one of the things that stops us from getting involved is this feeling like, well, I can't make a difference. I can't, even if I do take the action, I won't be there. So it's interesting to notice, I think, the possibility of, I don't care. I don't care if you're going to get it right or get it wrong. I want you in the game, back to the relationship piece. You don't get to remain parv in the face of tragedy, travesty, or even just challenge. I don't think you get to remain silent in the face of that. Okay, there were more people who wanted to speak before, and I didn't let them. Yes. Good.
I think God, throughout Jewish tradition, is telling us to take, as Ben was saying, to take an active role. And that's what was the leading Jewish number 5, was that you needed, it wasn't just enough to throw the keys out.
Good.
And just say, yeah, yes, sir.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Good.
A very important word is apathetic.
Mm.
The word indifference almost isn't an active word. But the word apathetic is taking active word and making you passive.
Beautiful. It's interesting. I was just thinking of the word adishut. So in my mind, the adishut translates to indifference, or maybe not. Maybe apathy is better. Right? Does tolerance lead to apathy? I just don't care about anything, right? Okay, good. That's a very, very nice point. Good. Nadia, you wanted to say something?
Mm-hmm.
and give me everything on a silver platter that we were given, and then we complained when things didn't quite happen. We had two spies who said, actually, we can do it. So I don't want a parallel, but I'm kind of paralleling, making a parallel between the fact that we couldn't do anything in Europe. We were virtually nothing. Not saying exactly, you know, we had Warsaw ghetto uprising and everything, but things changed from there, where we were helpless to coming to the Midianite world and do it. And there may have been people that said, look what happened in the past, in the Shoah. And there may have been other people, I'm sure, that I know there were, people who said, we can do it, and don't be apathetic, and at least we can die
trying. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
I think one of the difficult things is to know when we're supposed to act and when we're not.
Yes. Such an interesting question, right? And you know, I just want us to know, I don't know if people noticed this as we were going, how much of our time period has come into this conversation, right? Israel, the Shoah. It's just interesting to me, because that's the beauty of, really, just as an aside, of learning and of understanding and of commemorating time, is that you can't actually stop yourself from tying, right, what we're actually living and experiencing to what they experienced, and that's really what we're trying to do today. So I just wanted to look at source number 5, because I think that point, I'm so sorry, can you just tell me your name?
Chava.
Okay, so Chava says something, it's such an interesting question, right? Okay, so action, but what action, and how do I take action, and when, and is all action equal, or, right, and what stops me, I think is a really interesting question. So here, source number 5, this is like my favorite midrash of all time, okay? Tanur Banan. I'm in source number five, okay? Our sages taught, and this again is in the context of understanding what happened on Tisha B'Av. Mishacharav habayit barishona, the first temple is being destroyed. Nikbitzu kitot kitot shel pirchei kehuna. And just that language, I just want you to listen to that language, so beautiful. Nitkabtsu, they gather together, kitot kitot, groups of pirchei kehuna, right? And we call them pirchei kehuna because it means that they're just little blossoming flowers of priests. Okay, young, beautiful. Like, the preciousness here is incredibly powerful. Precious, sweet, young priests gather together in small groups. Umaftechot ha'echal biyadan. And the keys to the temple are in their hands. And they really were keys, it seems to be. They really were guards and keys. It's a very interesting phenomenon, but the keys to the temple are in their hands, okay? The alu legag ha-hechal, and they go up to the roof of the temple. The amru. Amru lefanav, sorry, and they stay in front of him, God. Ribono shel olam, master of the universe, ho'il v'lo zachinu liyot gizbarin ne'emanim, yiyu maftechot mesurot lecha. Since we were not able, we did not merit to be faithful Gizbarim, right? Curators, keepers, watchers of the temple. We're throwing the keys back up to you. Okay? Vizarkum klapei mala. And they throw the keys to the temple back up to the heavens. And what happens? The yetzta ke'ein, which is the Gemara's way of saying we don't really think God has a hand, but like a hand, right? Comes down and takes them from them. And what do? And then, right? They jump into the flames. Presumably the temple here is on fire. They jump from the roof into the flames. Yeah, it's a devastating, devastating piece. I want to understand. Can you help me understand this? How did you understand what is happening in this Midrash is really not the right words, but Agadah, let's say, this story. What is being told to us? Yes, sir.
The young priest felt totally demoralized.
Go ahead. Okay, fantastic. The only choice I have is to throw the... Good, so there's a demoralization here. They are heartbroken. They're devastated. There's nothing else. Fine, God. So it's a statement of, I have nothing else to do. You take back the temple. I'm going to, right, end my life. Yes? Right? Good.
They took the blame. We're not worthy.
Yafeh. It's a very interesting thing here. It's a very interesting question. Is this, I wonder, I think you can read this Midrash in many different ways, but I wonder about this. Is this actually a critique of God in some way? Or is this a critique of themselves? There's a self-critique here. Or on the part of the rabbis critiquing the Kohanim, which is a whole other conversation we can talk about for a while. But I think it's an interesting question. What is the critique in this story, besides it being heartbreaking? What is the critique that the rabbis are trying to teach me? Okay, so we already have here, right? There is a moment here because they say, listen, Lo Zachin, we didn't merit. We thought we were taking good care of this temple, and actually we realized that we were not ne'emanim. We were not faithful to you, God. We're taking this on ourselves, and so sorry. I'm sending these keys back up to heaven, right? And if we're reading it that way, though, John, then God's hand coming down to take the keys is what?
Confirms it,
right? You're right, guys, you didn't do a good job. Okay, I'm out. I'm taking my keys back. The severing of the relationship is complete, and then of course they're demoralized and there's no way for them to go except, right? Okay, good. Okay, we're going. Just give me one second. So sorry. Give me one second. Yes, sir.
I agree with Robert, they were demoralized, but maybe they weren't totally demoralized. If they were totally demoralized, they would jump in with the keys.
Good, good. Effect. We weren't able to, but we haven't lost faith. We were not, right? Beautiful. Tell me your name, sir. I'm sorry. Bruce. Beautiful, right? Maybe, right? I just think it's such an interesting question. What is this throwing back? So it means, okay, I am, right? We couldn't do it. Lo zachinu, we didn't merit. We were not ne'emanim, but there will be people in the future who will be able to rebuild, and God's hand there does not confirm, right, the destruction of the relationship, but actually confirms that, fine, I'm taking it back, and I will give them back to the next group that's able to do it. Yes? Okay, good. Yes. Just tell me your name, sir.
Peter.
Good. Good. Right. So there is a hope. There's a hopefulness in the giving of the keys back. Beautiful. Yes.
Hi, my name's Peter. I read it very sarcastic.
Oh.
God. They're not good enough.
See ya. Right. Yeah. Right. So it's so broken. We're so broken that it's so broken. Fine. It's the ultimate act of indifference then in your read. The ultimate act of giving up. Well, there's no hope here. We're going to die. With nothing else to talk about. Nothing else to do. Okay. We're going to take your point. Yeah. Good. Excellent. Beautiful. Beautiful. Beautiful, right? Oh my God, I don't know. I inherited this. I don't even know. I inherited this. I was supposed to be my responsibility. I wasn't able to do it. I didn't really realize. No one ever taught me. I'm not, right? So it's true. It's interesting, like this idea of them being young. Priest is so important here, right? Because either they weren't taught properly or maybe it wasn't their responsibility, actually. I don't know. I became a Kohen yesterday. I'm 21. Right? I become a Kohen at 20. I don't know. And now I've inherited this travesty, right? And maybe because my father's, which is, by the way, back to that point about Rabbi Yochanan saying, yeah, we inherited this trait of nuchal lo nuchal. We can't do it. We can't. So the crying of the generations, perhaps, is this idea of, like, we've inherited this responsibility, and unless we have faithful teachers who have taught us what to do, right, then we won't know what to do, actually, which is a really interesting question back to our leadership point. Okay, my friends, I see your hands, and I want to take them so much, and I must end in the next 2.5 minutes, okay? And we only have 3 more sources to do before then. So, okay. I just want to say that I think that this text can be both things, can simultaneously be a moment, we can read this as a moment of them giving up and abandoning faith, it's fine, I could, and a moment of acknowledging that they had lacked responsibility here. They had not fulfilled what they were supposed to do. What's fascinating is then, that's not the end of the story, as always is true in our tradition, right? The Gemara goes on to say, and this is like what Isaiah said in chapter 22. And Isaiah in chapter 22 is giving a chazon, a vision for Yerushalayim, and he says there that one day they're going to come into the city and they're going to take over, and you will go up on your roofs, he says. That's referring to these Kohanim, these priests who in fact did that, right? Source 6. Right, you will go up on your roofs, right? And, right, your slain are not slain of the sword, nor the dead of battle. Actually, you did abdicate responsibility and did not fight. You went up to the top of the Heichal, top of the temple, you threw the keys back and said, it's all in your hands, God, and God says, fine, literally it's in my hands, right? But by doing so, you have abdicated your responsibility. I don't want you, don't jump off the roof. It's true you messed up. What's interesting to me about this source is, what if they had said, we messed up, God, we're so sorry, give us swords and shields. What would have happened, right? The fact that they said, right, we are not, we take responsibility, but there's nothing we can do now, that step, I think, is an interesting move on the part of this text. And that's what Yeshayahu is critiquing them about. Fascinatingly, the chapter of Isaiah goes on to talk about, there was another response. So one of the responses to the fact that the temple was going to be destroyed was these young, beautiful Kohanim who threw the keys back up to heaven, right? Critiquing themselves and perhaps critiquing God as well. But there was another response, which was, there was a group of people, if you look at the Isaiah chapter 22 here, there was a group of people who said, oh, we're going to die anyway. We might as well party. Yeah. We're going to die anyway. We might as well party. Literally, that's that, right? If we look here, source number 6, verse 13. Instead, there was rejoicing and merriment, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine, right? Eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, right there in Isaiah 22, 13. It's right there, okay, my friends? Let's eat and drink, because we're going to die tomorrow, which is a fascinating thing. To me, the fact that Isaiah chooses to place in the same chapter these Kohanim, these beautiful Kohanim who went up to the roofs and said, we did mess up, right? And we're throwing the keys back to you, God. We're not taking responsibility, together with those who say, I don't know what's going to happen. There's nothing I can do, but my life is great. I'm doing just fine. My stock portfolio is up. I have the condo I always wanted, right? I have a boat, the whole deal. Everything is great. My kids just got into Harvard Law School. Everything is awesome, right? When the world is falling apart, right? That is the same thing in Isaiah's world as the leaders who abandoned the people and refused to fight. I want us to understand, in Isaiah's world, those are the same thing, okay? And that's what source number 7, and with this I promise we're going to end. Source number 7 comes along and says to us, Tanya Idach, right? Bizman sha'tzibur sharui b'tzar al yomar adam elech lebeiti v'ochav v'yeshtev v'shalom alayich nafshi, right? When the community is in trouble, let not a person say, I will go to my house and I will eat and drink and all will be well. For one who does so, scripture says, look what happens to him, my friends, right? Look what happens, okay? I'm in source 7. For one who does so, scripture says, and behold, joy and gladness, slaying oxen and killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. Isaiah 22, 13. What follows after this verse, the Gemara says, and the Lord of hosts revealed himself in my ears. Surely this sin shall not be forgiven to you until you die. And then look at the bottom of the Gemara here, my friends. Skip to the bottom. But rather a person should share in the distress of the community. For so we find that Moshe, our teacher, shared in the distress of the community. As it says, Moshe's hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. Listen to this, guys. Listen to this. Those of us who are sitting on the floor, this is particularly appropriate. Surely Moses had a pillow or a cushion to sit on. So it's so great. Come on. The Gemara is so fantastic. Isn't that amazing? What? Why did Moshe sit on a stone? Surely he had a pillow. Did he have a pillow? Probably not. What's the Gemara trying to say? What's the Gemara trying to say? But why do they bring up this pillow point? Because leadership often has things that we don't have. They often do have more luxuries. And we today, my friends, we are a people of pillows. I think that that's true. We are sitting on pillows. We are in great, thank God, right? We are in great, we have great comforts in the world, okay? And it is easy. What's interesting here, my friends, is when you are in a position of leadership, it is easy to be removed from the people. When things are luxurious and comfortable, it is easy. Part of what is going on in this text is when you are one of the young Kohanim, life is good. I mean, it is. Let's be honest. Life is good, and you have wealth, and you have enough, and you have meat, and you have wine, and it is good. And the normal reaction to having everything that you need is to feel like it's not my problem. Right? And Moshe Rabbeinu said, I'm going to make sure that I am in pain. I don't allow myself to feel that comfort. Don't allow yourselves to be comfortable, the Gemara says. And look at this, my friends, the last line. Why? Because whoever shares in the distress of the community will merit to behold its consolation, which is exactly how we started, right? If you mourn with Jerusalem, you will merit to see it be rebuilt and be in its joy. But what's interesting about that is the Gemara adds another piece here, which is it's not enough to just be with the people. You have to take part in the pain. You have to take part in the responsibility and in the leadership. Many people I know think, what can I do, little me? That's how we started, right? You know who else felt that way? What can I do, little me? Moshe. That's the classic Moshe Rabbeinu, right? That was Moses' whole problem. Me? Who am I? Don't pick me. And what we see here is the Gemara has turned him into the person who rejects all of the physical comforts in order to be with the people. So perhaps, one of the messages we can take away this Tisha B'Av is when we are comfortable and things are good, it is easy to forget the pain of the people, to forget the pain of the world. It is easy. And so the Gemara asks us, I think, to make sure that we are in the pain, wherever it is, and whatever part is ours that we feel, to stay in that and to allow it to spur us to action because we can. And that is the great tikkun of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av tells us you might think you can't, you actually can, right? Nuchal, we can if we try. And with that, I'm going to end. Thank you guys very much. It should be a meaningful Tisha B'Av, and we should be merit in our mourning to see Yerushalayim rebuilt. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.